copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'll start off this presentation just by saying that as we look at the situation in the world today, we have to acknowledge with each other that capitalism hasn't quite delivered all that we thought it would. And even though it hasn't, however, we still need to acknowledge that a system that is based on human endeavor is still the absolute best way, the most effective way, to create, or at least to try and create, prosperity for all. And so, as I speak this afternoon about system change, I'm not going to do it from the point of view of bashing a particular system, because to be very honest with you, I really think that all systems will fail at one point or another. Why? Because all systems are fallible, because we as humans are fallible. And so this afternoon, as we speak about things, we're going to talk about principles and how they can be applied. But I'm going to structure my talk in the following way. First of all, we're going to talk a little bit about the features of our current global economic system. We're then going to move on to looking at five dominant worldviews and also the historical roots of capitalism. And when I talk about dominant worldviews, we're also going to have a little bit of interaction in that section. So it is going to be a workshop kind of format. The third thing that we're going to talk about is where have we come, or where have we arrived since the time of Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism. And the last thing is we're going to look at some system change initiatives. So we will start. Features of our global financial system. Our financial systems, even though they have differences according to nations, all are characterized by three particular features. And number one is each one of our features is characterized by multilateral and bilateral treaties. We've made treaties with each other. And why is that important? It's important for the movement of capital, because that's foundational to the system that we have right now. The second characteristic of our global economic system is that we have banks. Every system in the world is characterized by the existence of banks that control the money supply and by governments that also influence financial policy. And the third and the last system of our global financial system I'm going to mention today before we get into things is that all of them are characterized by something called fiat money, F-I-A-T, fiat money. Now, fiat money is actually the currency that we use. It's the bills, the notes that we use, a 1 euro note, a 10 euro, a 1 euro coin, 10 euro note, etc. And why is it called fiat money? Because fiat money has value because we say it has value. And so that means that if I print a 10 euro note, it's not that that piece of paper is worth 10 euros, but it has value because we agree together, all right, we will say that that is worth 10 euros. And that's fiat money. And so all of our systems are characterized by that. And what does fiat money do? It makes it easier to exchange goods and services. That's what it does. It makes payment easier. Okay, now we're going to start by taking a look at some of the dominant worldviews throughout history and also in the world today. And we're going to look at their ability to change things. I'm going to use colors today to look at or to denote these worldviews. And these colors do not have a particular meaning. They are just colors. And so that means when I'm talking about the red view today, the red view is not communist or socialist, it's just red. And when I talk today about the green view this afternoon, I'm not going to be talking about the Greens or the environmental movement specifically. They are just colors. We're going to start with the black view of society. Now, the black view is dominant in tribal societies and Arab societies, and also green movements. Interesting. They have things in common with each other. Why? Because they're all characterized by a fear of and a desire to live in harmony with nature. They're characterized by a fear of God, and I put that with a small g, or the gods, a whole host of gods. And they're also characterized by a desire to live in consonance, that is, in agreement, internal agreement, with a certain idea of faith and how that's exercised. Now, this black view of the world is very prevalent in certain societies with a large number of people. It's important to say, however, that any black view of the world may like to change the system, but it's not geared towards system change. And why do I say that? It's because black views of the world, views of the world that incorporate these things, tend to like to move towards stability. Stasis is the English word for that, and they don't like change. And so now you get a little bit of an assignment for me. I'm just going to ask you, just with the person beside you, if you take 2 minutes, just to kind of brainstorm a little, in what groups in Europe do we find this black view of the world? What are the people groups in Europe among which we find this black view of the world? The black view of the world, once again, may like to change things, but because they are inherently geared towards stability, stasis, it's not going to move. The next group of the world, view of the world we're going to look at is the white view, and once again, colors do not mean anything. They are simply colors in this particular talk. And this view is dominant in non-tribal parts of the world, and the key feature of the white view of the world is that it prioritizes the other world, the world beyond this one. And it prioritizes that world to such a degree that this world doesn't really matter anymore. It's the other world that matters. And so you're just kind of passing through here. I'm going to just say we don't even have to brainstorm on that one. I think there are certain, once again, these are generalizations, but certain elements of Buddhism, for example, would qualify for that. Hindu societies definitely are characterized by this sort of belief and emphasis on the other world. Muslim societies, some groups of Muslims are characterized by this. Interesting enough, also Eastern Orthodox, a little bit Roman Catholic, a bit, and maybe even some areas of Protestantism, too. Evangelicals and Protestantism, yeah, we are not exempt. We are not immune from that. And so, the white view of the world. Once again, the world is not important, this world is not important, and that belief lessens our ability to effect effective change here on this earth. Who's defined these definitions? I'm getting, I've got a book list on here, and some of the definitions are coming from a book by Vishal Malgawadi called The Book to Change Our World. Okay, I respect his view on things. The next view is the yellow view, and that is found in most empires and dictatorships. And one of the key features of this is that you are not encouraged to or allowed to ask questions. Don't ask hard questions. Do not rock the boat. Now, sort of system, the elite may or may not take a disproportionate share of the benefits of society. However, interestingly enough, some yellow societies in the past have been very, very successful at producing effective change. It's difficult, but it's not impossible. And if you look at economic progress, for example, Egypt under the pharaohs would be one example of a society at that time that had enormous economic change and fell into this category. We're going to continue. Once again, the ability of people who hold this worldview to effect change depends largely on the leaders. We're going to go to the green view now, and once again, these are not the Greens. These is not the environmental movement. Now, the green view is historically unprecedented before the 16th century in Europe, and it influences most parts of the world today. And it has to do with the Protestant Reformation and how that changed our view of society. Interestingly enough, not all of the reformers today are Protestant. You have people who are trying to be reformers who are, belonging to Hindu communities, some Muslim communities, etc. If you examine them closely, however, if you question them close enough, what you'll see is that most of the principles that they deem to be important for change and for reformation come from Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And so this is a very, very unprecedented view of the world before the 16th century. And what characterized it? Actually, during the Protestant Reformation, the people were told that it's not just good that they learn how to read, but that it's their religious duty that they learn how to read, and that they learn how to think for themselves. This was a break with tradition from that time on, and that's extremely important. That's a faith word. People are told that it's not just their religious duty, an act of faith to learn how to read, it's your duty to read and to start to think for yourself. And interestingly enough, too, democracy, even though it's not a Christian concept, democracy came from the Greeks, but democracy was not able to be sustained for hundreds of years at a time until this worldview became widely accepted. In Greek, I'm saying it very broad brushstrokes, so I'll be with you in a moment, Hank. But in Greece, what you notice is that they started out with democracy, but they ended with Alexander the Great. And one of the main reasons, or that the societies that have been able to sustain democracy for a long period of time have been able to do it, is because they have adopted tenets of this particular worldview. And so that is the green view of the world. And you can say to a certain degree, even though we are far from our roots right now as a society, it still makes up a large part of our DNA. What was the result of the green view of the world? Unprecedented progress, especially for Northern Europe, with this group of the world. Northern Europe went from being one of the poorest areas of the world to, within a period of about 200 years, becoming one of the richest areas of the world when adopted the green view of society. And in the 18th century, for example, the 1700s, we caught up with China and with India. And after that, we passed those societies by with regards to economic progress. Okay? It's the only indicator I'm looking at right now. Our last view of the world that we're going to talk about today before we move on is the red view of the world. And that is important because it is currently the dominant philosophy of the global elite. If you live in a high or middle income company, this will probably be your dominant view of the world to a large degree. And this dominant view of the world came in from the Enlightenment of the 17th century. And it's characterized by a number of things. Number one, that science and technology will solve all of our problems. We know, however, that science and technology are limited in their ability to solve problems, and they actually create some new problems which we weren't able to anticipate. A second characteristic of this system is that markets will look after themselves if they are left alone. Now, I am an advocate of the free market system, but we need to start to really take a look at things here. One of the things that we've believed is that markets are free and they're anonymous, and I think most of us know today that markets can be manipulated. Markets can be manipulated. I'm saying that, pardon me?
Are manipulated.
Trying to be friendly in saying that, but they are manipulated at times. A couple of examples, but there are many to name. The gold price, which was kept very, very low after it went off of the gold standards for years. And also, even if you just look at wages between CEOs and the lowest paid workers, there are many, many examples to name. But that is the second fundamental tenet upon which this worldview rests. A third and very important tenet upon which this worldview rests is that morality, ethics, laws are unnecessary inconveniences to be gotten around as best you can. And so we don't, ethics, morals, not in fashion any longer. And that's essentially what characterizes this. Now, the consequences of this worldview are many, but on the one hand, it means that with the green view, you had unprecedented economic progress for Europe. With the red view, you get unprecedented global progress economically. With this view, we've seen millions and millions of people lifted out of poverty. We've seen millions enter the middle class. However, with this view also, we've seen the gap between income, between rich and poor, expand exponentially to the point that it's starting to threaten to destabilize our societies. With this view, we see that nature and environment don't really count that much, and they tend to be exploited rather than cared for. And with this view, we also see that wealth is increasingly being concentrated in the hands of a smaller and smaller group of individuals. So we need to start to rethink our systems, because we're starting to see cracks in the system even now. I don't know if you've noticed, but on the news, for example, in South Africa, a couple of weeks ago, there were riots of South African blacks against some of the people from Zimbabwe and some of the other immigrants coming in. Even though you could look at that as a social and ethnic problem, if you look at the unemployment in South Africa, especially among the black community, that's getting up to 40% or more right now. All of our nations are kind of dealing and grappling with these things. The Occupy movement, they're also protesting against just injustices in that area. And the World Economic Forum has written that actually when you have a large number of people percentually, especially young men under the age of 40 who have a high rate of unemployment, that is a recipe for social unrest. And so we are being forced to have to look at that now. It's also important to say that this red view of the world rose or started to rise when people in Europe started to reject the green view, when they started to reject Protestant reform values, when we started to reject God, when we started to reject the Bible. And the red point of view came as a key characteristic of a rejection of Christian faith and tradition. That was the response that we got to that. So we're moving now towards what has happened since then. Since the Reformation and since the time of Adam Smith. Adam Smith is the father of modern capitalism. Since that time, we've become more individualistic, among other things. We really, really believe that the good of society is served best if we all pursue our own self-interests. We therefore don't need to look out for the welfare of others. Since the time of Adam Smith, we've become more reductionist. That has to do with the fact that the scientific method, which has been responsible for so much progress, has also taught us that the best way to solve complex problems is to reduce them to their respective parts and look at those parts individually. That has had advantages, but it limits our ability to be able to understand systems. And in order to solve the problems we're being confronted with today, we have to move away from reductionist thinking and to learn to think holistically again. That's the only way we'll be able to understand systems. Since the time of Adam Smith, we've become more utilitarian. And utilitarianism is the belief that actions are right and good if they benefit the majority of people in society. And economics claims to be an amoral space, where what matters most is putting scarce resources to work. However, in believing this, utilitarianism, we have inverted the order of things now. And we've actually turned people and individuals into subjects that are serving financial utility instead of those whom financial utility was always meant to serve. And so we've become more utilitarian. Since the time of Adam Smith, we have become more disparate. Freedom of choice has been elevated to such a standard right now where it's difficult for us to agree on a common goal or even on a common destination. And especially when you take faith out of the equation, values, ethics, morals out of the equation, we've lost our way. And since the time of Adam Smith, we have become more arrogant and more pragmatic. Our technical progress has made us overconfident. And we've made the mistake of treating economics as a natural science instead of a social science. It's very interesting. I was reading an article last week in the Financial Times, and actually it was saying that our obsession with continuous growth in economics is actually hurting the capitalist system, and they are free market proponents. It's hurting the capitalist system. We believe the efficient market hypothesis that more perfect markets are created by ever-increasing economic activity and endless growth. And so a lot has happened since the time of Adam Smith. And what I'd like to propose today is that in addition to these things, which is causing capitalism, the form of capitalism that we know to turn in on itself, we also are in a period of not unprecedented change, but very significant change, not only as Europe, but as a world. There are things, spoke about it today in Lease My Track, there are things that are happening today in society that are causing society to change so fundamentally that we're never, ever going to go back to the way things were. And every time we encounter a change of age, the economic system that supports the era also changes. And we are at that time right now. 2 years ago, in 2012, I read an article in one of our Dutch papers by a gentleman named Paul Kennedy. He is a professor at Yale University. And he said that society is at a watershed moment of history right now. Another way of saying it, we are at a tipping point moment in history right now. And he said, one of the things that characterizes tipping point moments in history is that people do not realize that they are in them. And he said, if you, for example, one of those tipping point moments in history was the Protestant Reformation. Said, if you could have taken someone who lived in 1480 and propelled them with a time machine up to 1530, they would not have recognized what the world had become. Why? Because in that time you had the invention of the printing press. At that time, Christopher Columbus, 1492, he sailed from Europe and he discovered the New World. North American native peoples would argue that they discovered that, but he discovered it for Europe, the New World. At that time also you had the Protestant Reformation, things that shifted societally so totally that things did not go back to ever being the way they were again. We had another period like this when we had the Industrial Revolution in the late 1780s. We are at a similar shift again. And so it's reasonable to expect that things will shake. It is reasonable also to expect that systems will shake and will change. So what do we need to do? One of the, proposing three things. Not proposing a system, but I'm proposing we need to move away from individualism and become more relational, not only in our thinking, but in our doing. I'm going to expand on that in a little while. We need to move away from reductionism, that's breaking things down and just looking very in a blinkered fashion at things, and we need to become more holistic in our view of the world and of things. And we need to move away from utilitarianism. And we need to become more adept at practicing mutuality. Now, when I talk about mutuality, mutuality is a word that describes the concept of fairness, and good practice. Mutuality is a word that describes the concepts of fairness as in eerlijkheid in Dutch. So not fearless, but being honest in our dealings with people, being fair instead of unfair in our dealings with people, and good practice. And mutuality is something that we are going to have to become adept at practicing also in business. 90% of economic growth in any society comes through business. And so as a result, we're going to have to be adept at practicing that. What does that look like? I'm going to give you a few examples, just examples from people who I know who are doing things right now that have to do with this. First of all, I'm going to read you a definition. I think it's a wonderful definition of mutuality. And it's from a particular multinational, and the founder of this multinational penned this definition, not so much of mutuality, it wasn't that he defined it, but he did it. He was a Christian, and he was a founder of the Mars Corporation. Now, if you think of Mars, you usually think of Mars bars. I certainly did, but they are the largest food manufacturing company in the world, and they do much more than just Mars bars. They are in almost every nation of the world in some way or another. Mars. M-A-R-S. You know the Mars chocolate bars? Yeah. And the founder of that company, Forrest Mars, he wrote this on July 28th, 1947, after World War II. And he said, the company's objective is the manufacture and distribution of food products in such a way as to promote a mutuality of services and benefits among consumers, distributors, competitors. And as said also this morning, when was the last time you heard a company trying to benefit its competitor? Also, too, our direct suppliers, governmental bodies, all employees, and, as last, the shareholders of the company. This expresses the total purpose for which the company exists, nothing less, and it is expected that the board of directors, all management, and employees of the company will be motivated by this basic objective and will keep it constantly in mind as a guiding principle in all their work for the company. Or July 28, 1947, that was when he founded the company. Mars today is the largest food-producing company. They have a budget, or a turnover, sorry, of $40 billion. And that is more than some large company or countries, their GDPs. And this is still their philosophy today. And what does that cause them to do? It causes them, for example, now, to start to ask the question, which they asked about 7 years ago to a friend of mine, How much profit is enough? Interesting. How much profit is enough for us a company? That's what they're starting to ask the question about. And interestingly enough, they're starting to get some very, very unique answers. And one of the answers that they're coming up with is that if you start companies with keeping the factors that promote social cohesion and community in mind and supporting those processes and looking at the environment, that in more than 9 out of 10 cases, 99 out of the 100 cases, the profit will follow. Interesting. It's starting to support something that I think intrinsically we had the feeling, hey, this would be good if it actually worked. It's starting to work. Now, for those of you who are thinking, yeah, this is nice, but it will never catch on in other companies, the new CEO of Danone recently, last month, so this is fresh from the press news, contacted the CEO of Mars Corporation to say, we would like to transition Danone into mutuality, and mutuality in all of our operations. They are also a very large multinational corporation. Yeah, yeah, Danone, yeah, yeah. Yogurt, oh, yeah, yeah. etc. We know them for dairy and yogurt, yes, but once yeah, again, yeah. they also produce a lot. So there is an aspect of the fact that doing good is good for business that is starting to become very appealing also to people who run large corporations. On a smaller level, a micro level, a friend of mine, he used to be the chief operating officer for Hershey's Chocolate in America. And 5 years ago, because he felt that God had been speaking to him, he and his wife, they packed up their belongings and they moved to Maputo in Mozambique. And he wasn't the sort of person who adapts easily to being a missionary. He's an entrepreneur. And so he did what was natural to him. He started a business in cashew nuts. But the thing that appealed to me about what he was doing when I met him was what he felt that he had received in prayer to do with the prophets. And essentially, that is that he gives 90% away of the profits after he's paid his bills, and 10% he keeps and reinvests in the company. And that 90% is targeted giving. 30% goes towards the operational budget of orphanages in that area. There are many orphans and people who need help. 30% of the profit goes towards improving the infrastructure in the villages and towns that his employees come from, building roads, schools, hospitals, that kind of thing. And 30% of those profits goes towards creating and building centers of excellence in education, in business, in other fields to help the people in those areas to get ahead. Now, this sounded also too good to be true, but when I was in Mozambique in Maputo this past March, I was able to visit the factory. It's up and it's running. He has his first 25 employees on that. They're all graduates of some of the local orphanages in the area. And he's now got companies with a hold, or contracts with Ahold USA, Pick n Pay, big South African supermarket, etc. What are these large chains, grocery store chains, finding attractive about his cashew nut product? The philosophy behind it. And so we really are living in an age right now where I think people, whether they are believers or unbelievers, are starting to long again for some kind of norm, some kind of value behind the things that we create and produce. And so system change, is it enough to tinker at the margins with the period that we're in right now? Answer is, I don't think so. Things are changing so radically that even if we wanted to keep the system, it's going to be changing radically anyway. And so I think as believers, one of the things that we can do is to be prepared with possible solutions as things change. Crisis, change often leads to crisis, but crisis can open doors of opportunity that we never dreamed of before. And so with that, to say thank you for your attention.